This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here, we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our site at thepeoplespeakradio.net. There, you can also listen to live shows or our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's thepeoplespeakradio.net. And if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen via satellite. Just go to the website for details. Tonight we have a fascinating guest. I personally am so pleased to have Angela Davis with us tonight, Professor Angela Davis. In the 60s, Angela was put on the FBI's most wanted list when she was just 26 years old. And she became an enduring symbol of the black power in this country. Ms. Davis is known by many as the iconic face of black pride, and others know her as the former vice presidential candidate of the Communist Party of the United States, and yet others know her as a feminist scholar. Tonight we are just absolutely thrilled to have you with us, Angela. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
We know who Angela Davis is. I can't believe that, I mean, whether you wanted it or not, you have an infamous history. Who is Angela Davis today?
Well, you know, part of that history, of course, is of my doing, but a good part of that history has to do with the fact that so many people rallied behind me when I was facing repression, when I was facing the death penalty three times. So I like to think of that as the story of masses of people who came together and demonstrated that state power could be effectively challenged. And who am I today? Well, I like to think that I continue to contribute in various ways to the quest for social justice. You know, whether it's racial justice or gender justice, whether it is justice for the many millions of people who have been touched by the prison system in this country and throughout the world.
And as Angela Davis today, how much has it really changed from your beginning, Angela? Aren't these the same issues that you've been challenging all your life?
Well, in a sense, they are the same issues, but our understandings of these issues have changed. And I like to think that the struggles of the late 60s and the early 70s helped to create a very different kind of terrain for people to understand hierarchies of power. And so today we begin with very different premises than we began, say, in the late 60s. When we talk about racism today, we understand something that is far more complicated, something that is systemic and structural and inscribed into the very fabric of the institutions of our society.
Let me ask you... Much of your work has surrounded the issues of gender and racist and the issues that many face in these areas. Senator Hillary Clinton's close race as a presidential candidate was touted as a victory for women. Senator Barack Obama's presidential win was declared a historic and precedent as far as a triumph for the African Americans. Who have sought equality. Has gender and racial equality come a long way since the 60s?
Well, I would have to answer that question by saying yes and no. Both yes and no. Of course there's been progress. We see evidence of progress all around us. Of course, some institutions have opened their doors. There are individuals who have been able to move into areas that would have been entirely barred to them in the 60s. But, and this is the point I was making before, structural racism and structural gender inequality is still very much with us. Women are still in a position, when we talk about the masses of women, are still in a position of economic inferiority to men, especially poor women, working class women, and especially women of color. Violence against women is still pandemic all over the country, all over the world. And, of course, I would say that today, despite the fact that we've made a great deal of progress with respect to the struggle for racial equality, I would say that structurally racism is perhaps even worse today than it was in the 60s. And my evidence of that would consist in part of the fact that such vast numbers of black people, people of color, are behind walls. We have to begin to think about these issues not simply in terms of how they affect specific individuals, but how they affect entire communities. And, of course, a couple of years ago in this country, people were astounded when they saw the faces of poor people in New Orleans as a result of the media focus on Hurricane Katrina. You know, that poverty exists all over the country, and that poverty is racialized. That has not changed. That has gotten perhaps even worse than it was during the early period of struggle for racial equality.
May I ask you to define for our listeners exactly what you mean by structural in our society in regards to racism and gender?
All right. I would say, well, specifically with respect to racism, it used to be the case that a certain racist attitudes were quite visible. People felt very comfortable in making certain kinds of statements about black people, about Latinos. Now that's no longer the case. As a matter of fact, we see that people can lose their jobs if they make racist statements on the radio or on television, etc. However, if one looks at the difficulty with which black people, for example, receive a good education in this country, that is an issue of structural racism. Access to education by racialized communities, by black communities, Latino communities, poor communities in general, as a matter of fact, access to education, which ought to be a human right, is simply, it simply hasn't happened. As a matter of fact, there's less access to education now at all levels than there was, earlier on. There's greater access to the prison system than there is to the educational system. And that would be an example of structural racism. People are not put in prison because they are because they are black. They are not arrested for very specifically racist reasons, but there's racism that lurks beneath every element, every stage in the system, the criminal justice system in this country.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, Angela, and you made a statement when many young people decide to join the military service in order to avoid the inevitability of a stint in prison, it should cause us to wonder whether we should not try to introduce better alternatives. there was a connection between the lack of education and job opportunities, the increasing crime rate, and the resulting prison population growth. Now, we know that. In fact, it seems that John Kerry's statement about go to college or join the military way back makes the military the only option youth have today. If they don't go to college, where do you see this that means that they have to go to college. Now, where do you see this country headed in respect with President Obama and his plans to institute a national service plan?
Well, I'm really hoping that things change, radically. The military for poor communities becomes the only acceptable way out of poverty. As a matter of fact, if one chooses not to engage in the kind of behavior that will create a trajectory that leads to prison, and one cannot get funding for a college education, the military becomes the only alternative. Now, I think that the Obama administration has a huge agenda on its hands. It's not simply a question of instituting a national service plan, but it is a question of completely overhauling the educational system in this country, providing scholarships for students who cannot afford it. It will mean also making higher education accessible to people who are already in prison. So I'm hoping that we will be able to put the kind of pressure on the new president that will lead to some new and hopefully radical changes.
Let me ask you, Angela, do you believe America wants to educate its people?
Well, I don't think we have a choice.
Well, we don't. I think we do, because look at what we're looking at. In order for someone to graduate from college or university or any kind of a degree worth its salt, the average student is leaving with a $60,000 to $125,000 student loans. Is that a country that really wants its
Well, when you ask whether America really wants to educate its people, if you're asking whether corporate America wants to educate the people of this country,
I would
say
corrected.
No, because obviously education, like health care, has been so thoroughly commodified that it's only available to those who have the money to pay for it. And if this change in administrations is going to be meaningful in the long run, we're going to have to figure out over the next years, how to make education available. I personally think, as a person who has believed for many, many years that we need socialist or even communist solutions to this problem, I would suggest that we need an educational system that is free to everyone, an educational system that does not require those who make use of it to be in possession of the financial means with which to buy it, but rather simply have the talent and the enthusiasm and the desire and the perseverance to get an education. And in the process, they will be able to return to society.
And yet what we seem to be doing is moving towards even further isolation of the ability to reach an education by privatizing a lot of the schools. So are we straying even further from that?
Absolutely. And, of course, since the 1980s, we have witnessed the impact of global capitalism and the rise of a kind of neo-liberalism that wants to put a price tag on every single thing. And so privatization has been responsible for the deterioration of education. We have privatization of punishment, because there are those who realize that if huge numbers of people continue to be punished, then punishment itself can be rendered profitable. So, this question of privatization of health care, and this is really the only country in the world where there is a price tag on virtually everything that human beings need. And this is just a shame. I think now this is a period during which we really have to begin to have some conversations about, you know, what it means to inhabit this capitalist society. I think that people like Bernie Madoff are really metaphors for capitalism and what capitalism is willing to do.
Absolutely.
And when you consider that the whole economic crisis, the financial crisis, was brought on by banks and lending agencies who were out to exploit poor people. The subprime mortgages were about giving mortgages to people who could not afford them, knowing full well that they would at one point be in default.
Which brings me to one of your books, Are Prisons Obsolete? According to your understanding and how you feel about this, is that it isn't a matter of are prisons obsolete. I believe it should be prisons are obsolete. Not the other way, because in fact it isn't. I think we're dealing with more of a social problem, and I know that you've been writing about for many years, that this is a social problem that we have with the prisons, and you believe that we can be completely rid ourselves of the prison system and address the more critical issues of poverty, lack of education, the obvious issues of racism and bias?
Well, absolutely. I actually chose the title, Are Prisons Obsolete, because I wanted people to think deeply about the question. I didn't want to impose an answer, although I do believe they are, but I think that because of the fact that we take prison so for granted, that we think of them as a permanent part of our social landscape, that it is necessary to trouble people's sense of the permanence of prisons, and particularly at a time when we have experienced such an imprisonment binge that the contradiction, the core contradiction of using imprisonment as punishment has come to the fore. That is to say that the prison attempts to solve problems that are produced by poverty and illiteracy and lack of health care. And in this attempt to address these problems, it not only perpetuates those problems, but it reproduces them. And so we end up in a situation where the resources and the attention that should be focused on schools and that should be focused on health care and recreation and housing and jobs get focused on prisons. And now with with something like 2.3 million people behind bars, one in every 100 adults in this country is in prison. And that is astounding. There is not a country anywhere else on this planet that incarcerates so many of its people. there are more people in prison in this country than there are in China, many more people. And proportionately, there are more people in prison than anywhere else in the world. So, I think we've reached the point where we have to think about alternatives to imprisonment. We have to ask ourselves why so many people are behind bars, why so many people who are in prison are people who come from racially oppressed communities, black people, of course, Latinos, Native Americans, Asian Americans, and poor communities in general.
Let me ask you, obviously we have an issue that there are some criminal factions that need to be dealt with. What would be the alternative to dealing with people? Because that's the first question people are going to ask. Okay, we get rid of prisons and we start to address poverty and all of the associated ilks with that. What do you do with violent offenders?
Okay, well, actually, that's kind of putting the cart before the horse. But I want to answer that question. But I want to say first of all that the way to abolish prisons as the dominant mode of punishment is precisely to create the other institutions. And so, in my understanding, it's better schools that will result in fewer people being sent to prison. It's better mental health care that will result in fewer intellectually disabled people being sent to prison. However, there is that question that people always ask. What about the rapists and the murderers? What about the child molesters? That question always comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And, certainly, we don't, want to encourage or promote any more violence. This is already a society that is so thoroughly steeped in violence. But I would ask the question, why do we assume that we can create a society that is free of violence simply by sending all of the perpetrators to prison? By sending people who commit horrible acts, and I'm talking about actually a very small minority of the people who are in prison. The majority of people who are in prison have not committed so-called violent crimes, but many people imagine the prison as full of individuals who have committed the most horrendous kinds of violent acts. Now, there are, of course, some people who have committed these horrendous violent acts, and we have to ask ourselves, what is the source of this violence? Why do people do such horrible things? Why do people sexually assault children? Why is there so much violence against women in the world? These questions will never be answered as long as we assume that all we have to do is put the perpetrator behind bars. We know, for example, with respect to violence against women, violence against children, that usually people who commit these acts, and oftentimes people who are the targets of these acts, have grown up in families where such violence has been experienced at a very young age. We know that. We know that that violence is generational. Yet, we don't attempt to try to figure out how to solve the problem, how to get rid of the violence. Instead, we say, put the person who has committed the violence in prison. And in that way, we are perhaps inadvertently, but still we are reproducing the problem over and over and over again. So my question is this: if we really want to solve the problem of violent harm committed by individuals we're going to have to start figuring out, you know, how to understand the reasons behind this violence, and how to use all of our efforts to try to eradicate this violence once and for all. My problem with the prison is that as long as we continue to simply deposit these people in prison, we are saying that we will forever live with the problem of violence against women and violence against children.
Well, if putting people into prison worked, we now have over 2 million people incarcerated in the United States. And has our crime rate gone down?
There is no relationship between the rate of incarceration and the crime rate. You know, as a matter of fact, I often point out that the rate of imprisonment and the particular communities that contribute to the population that is now behind bars, those questions are related more to surveillance than they are to the actual crimes committed. And so you find that communities that are more subject to law enforcement surveillance will contribute more to prison populations, whereas the same kinds of crimes may be committed in other neighborhoods, but they are not subject to surveillance. It's as simple as that.
Mm. Absolutely. You know, the Bush administration authorized torture, and the world saw, of course, all of the unbelievably horrific and shameful acts in Abu Ghraib. The facility was once labeled the rape and torture rooms of Saddam Hussein. Guantanamo Bay, they keep saying that they're going to close it down, and yet we have seen no evidence of that. And even if Guantanamo Bay closes down, how many other covert torture chambers does the United States government have around the world? This kind of inhumane and illegal treatments, as far as prisoners are of the United States are concerned, I don't understand how we can. I think you had said it best when you said, can we suspend national and international law by even debating whether or not these things are acceptable? And obviously we can here in the United States, because isn't that exactly what we've done, Angela?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, I must say that I was happy that there was at least an announcement that Guantanamo Bay was going to be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
However, as
technically,
you pointed out,
actually, Angela, that was the second announcement. It was supposed to be shut down under Bush, and now.
Well, yes, so no. I mean, I understand that, and my point is that that we have to create the kind of pressure. You know, not only should the prison be shut down, but the U.S. military should, as Fidel Castro said, should return Guantanamo to the Cuban people. But that's another question.
Quite true.
But you know, you're absolutely right about the CIA secret prisons around the world, and also the connection between the torture in Abu Ghraib, in Guantanamo, and the secret prisons, the torture in those military prisons, and the kind of daily routine torture that happens in domestic prisons in this country. There is a connection between the technologies of imprisonment. You know, I always like to point out the extent to which cavity searches, strip searches to which women are subjected all over the world, that is a form of sexual assault, a form of of violence, a form of torture, if you will, that we never pay attention to. So, not only should we be concerned about trying to reverse so much of the damage that has happened under the guise of the so-called war on terror during the Bush administration, but we should also, look at the daily, routine acts of the little tortures that millions of people are subject to who are in prison all over the world.
Unbelievable, unbelievable. We're going to go to break right now, Angela and listeners. Our guest, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with our guest, Angela Davis. Get your questions ready.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world food program.
We used to write letters to each other a lot,
and it was intimidating to talk to him sometimes because he just seemed so isolated by himself.
She started talking about how she wishes that her life was over and she wishes that she was never born.
So I knew he had depression, but I didn't know it was that far. He
said something to me about killing himself.
Tell somebody, tell an adult, counselor, parent, whatever.
It's a hard situation because you do risk making that person very angry and losing their friendship.
It would have been horrible for me if she never talked to me again, but I'd live with it because I know she'd be alive.
Definitely worth getting help, even if you think you're going to lose a friendship, because it's better to lose the friendship than the actual friend.
Suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teens. For more information, contact the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, 888-333-AFSP, or online at afsp.org.
This land is your land.
Join us tonight on The People Speak as guest Professor Angela Davis talks with host Basima Farhat, along with your text or call-in questions. That's The People Speak, where we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. Every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, here on the BBS Radio Network.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us, but for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact a world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea by the relief on the fast summer.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio. Our guest tonight is Angela Yvonne Davis, Professor Angela Yvonne Davis, who is an activist and has primarily worked for racial and gender equality and for prison. For anti-prison situation. It says here prison reform, and I'm thinking, you're really not a reformist, are you?
You're absolutely right. I'd like to think of myself as a prison abolitionist.
Yes, yes.
I know that's not a term that a lot of people are familiar with today, but I identify not as a prison reformist because I don't really want to reform. I don't want to create a better prison. I do want to create a better situation for people who happen to be in prison, but I don't want to contribute to the permanency of the system of imprisonment.
Well, the term abolition itself, I looked it up, and I wanted to really make a statement about that. According to the dictionary, abolition is the act of formally repealing an existing legal practice, either by making it illegal or simply no longer allowing it to exist in any form. Now, you wrote a book that says Abolition Democracy Beyond Empire, Prisons, and Torture. Before we start taking our audience questions, which we have a bunch of, what did you mean by that?
Well, I like to think of abolition in a fuller sense. I like to think of it not only as the negative act of removing something from the social landscape or repealing or destroying or abolishing, but I also like to think of it as creating the conditions that make that institution if one can say, make it possible to truly abolish that institution. And I get this approach from W.E.B. Du Bois, who pointed out that when slavery was abolished, it was not truly abolished. It was not abolished within a democratic context, because for that to have been the case, it would have been necessary to create a economic equality, educational equality, political equality. Former slaves would have to have been fully incorporated into the society. And of course, we have spent over a century and a half, trying to achieve first-class citizenship for people of African descent. As long as the racism that is so much a part of our society today continues to exist, we will not have fully abolished slavery. And so I'm saying that in order to abolish prisons, we need that equality that should have been placed on the agenda with the abolition of slavery.
And you think that's possible, Angela?
Well,
it's a dream, and it's something that you have aspired and worked dedicatedly towards. But is it, in light of everything that's happened in the last few years, is it really a possibility in the near future?
Well, I don't know whether it will happen in the near future, but I do know that it is possible to engage in a process that moves in the direction of abolition. I do know it is possible to call for no more construction of prison buildings, no more prisons, a moratorium on prison construction. I do know it is possible to begin to remove all of the laws from the books that have been responsible for this vast imprisonment binge, such as the mandatory minimums, the three strikes laws, the Rockefeller laws in New York. As a matter of fact, there is discussion at this very moment about repealing all of those laws. I see all of these as part of an abolitionist's agenda. But I would say at the same time, I think that we have to begin to question the values that require prisons, that make prisons the guarantee of safety and security for so many people in this country. We assume that when something bad is done to us, the only way we can respond is by doing something bad to the person who has committed harm against us. So we have to begin to think of healing rather than retribution. And we need a justice system that's not based on retributive justice. It's not based on revenge, but that truly allows all of us to heal.
Well, absolutely. Well, whatever it is, it isn't working. Our crime rates have increased. We have a caller on the line for you, Angela. Mike from California has a question for you. Mike?
Hello. Ms. Davis, it's an honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
I have two questions for you. Yes, you're very welcome. I have two questions for you. Number one, did the University of California in Los Angeles ever reconcile with you after firing you after all these years? And my second question is, are you in contact with Mamia Abu-Jamal and following or assisting in his case?
Okay. Well, as far as the first question is concerned, you know, after I was released from jail and after I was acquitted in June of 1972, my former colleagues in the philosophy department at UCLA offered me my job back there, and it was a unanimous vote. Then Governor Reagan responded with an announcement that I would never again teach in the University of California system. And, of course, you know, for the last 16 years, I'm now a professor emeritus at UC Santa Cruz. So I did prove then Governor and later President Reagan wrong. So thanks for asking that question. With respect to the second question, yes, I am in touch with Mumia Abu-Jamal. He is an absolutely incredible advocate of justice. He, as a matter of fact, I just recently wrote a preface for his latest book, and the name of that book is Jailhouse Lawyers. It's a wonderful book that looks at the contributions of people in prison to what we now call prison law. And I can't tell you how important it is to spread the word about Mumia's case. I travel to Europe and find that in Europe, in Germany, in France, everyone there asks about Mumia Abu-Jamal. There are streets named after him. There are schools named after him. He's seen as a powerful advocate of death penalty abolitionism, and he's seen as an intellectual who uses his considerable talents to advocate justice for people all over the world. And here, of course, he is not recognized to that extent at all. but I should say that
amazing.
His new book will be is released. I think it's available now, and it's a wonderful contribution to scholarship on prison issues.
Absolutely. We have a question from Jack from Kentucky, and Jack asks, how does Ms. Davis feel about the CPUSA today? That's the Communist Party. And do you think that they will run candidates in the future?
Well, it's possible that the Communist Party USA will run candidates in the future. You know, I should say that I was a member of the Communist Party for many years. I am no longer a member of the Communist Party, but I still very much embrace the cause of struggling for socialism. And I can also say that I do think that independent party politics are very important in this country. As important as it may have been to have elected Barack Obama to the office of the presidency, the Democratic Party is still very much linked to corporate America. I mean, it may be less conservative than the Republican Party, but there's only so far that the Democratic Party will be willing to go. And therefore, we have to think very seriously about third parties, independent politics, and we need to think about how we might develop a conversation in this country that will lead us beyond capitalism.
Well, I certainly agree. Certainly agree with you when it comes to the Democratic Party being, as far as I can see, the other side of the same coin. So, hopefully, one day we'll be able to break free of the corporate chokehold that I have a feeling we won't have to. We may not have to wait too long. They may just crumble before us.
Yeah,
with
exactly.
The economic. I really think that might happen. We have a question from John in the Canadian Rockies, and he says, "Ms. Davis, now that we are the elders of social activism, what encouragement must we instill in those coming behind us?" And then he says, "Thank you for your wisdom and being who you are. We wish you every happiness."
Oh, well, thank you very much. I certainly appreciate that. And I'm very glad that you raised the question of the generationality of social activism. And, yeah, there are those of us who have been involved for many decades, and there's a new crop of young people emerging. And I must say that I am really excited about young people today. I'm talking about, you know, people in their late teens and early 20s. Of course, I'm also excited about older young people. But I think that there is something about this new generation that is going to lead us to a new place. I should say that what excited me so much about the Obama campaign was more the involvement of young people at the grassroots. And as a matter of fact, the kind of campaign that emerged, then I was more excited about that than I was about the candidate himself. And I'm still more excited about the possibility that young people will help us to develop the kind of movement that will demand more than the Democratic Party is willing to give us, and that may, you know, push us in a more radical direction. What do I have to say to young people? You know, I simply like to encourage young people to use their own imagination to find new and innovative and creative ways of engaging in struggle for racial, economic, gender, sexual equality, and for peace in the world.
You know, When we talk about all of these things, when we talk about passing on a legacy to our youth, one of my concerns is, and we had touched on it for just a minute during the interview, Angela, is that here we have a shattering of our economic structure in the United States. As I said, we may end up watching these multinational corporations just collapse onto themselves at the rate that they're going, and which is leaving a devastating mark on the employment of anybody in this country. These children, these youth, these young people, these adults are faced with turning towards the military. Do you think that this was, I mean, let's face it, even we as homemakers and radio hosts and people that live their daily lives knew that this had to collapse, that it had to come to an end. Are we and I can't possibly for 1 minute believe that our country and the think tanks and the Congress and the statisticians and any of the people that had any kind of understanding didn't know this. So why did they allow it to happen? And are they driving our youth into the military?
Well, it's a question that, we have to ponder. Didn't we know that this might happen? And, you know, it seems to me that the capitalist system is so much is so wedded to the production of ever more profit that even the possibility of collapse does not deter them.
Exactly.
And this is why I think we have to begin to talk about a different kind of socioeconomic system. And it is true that young people are being pushed into the military, but at the same time, I think there are vast numbers of young people who are really excited about building social movements that will perhaps produce some change in this country. And I have to acknowledge them, because I remember myself as a young person, and I remember the things we were doing that our elders could not understand, and they felt were totally insane. However, now we see that those actions that many may have disagreed with at one time have helped to produce a society that has a much greater understanding of and sensitivity, you know, towards issues of race and gender and class and sexuality. And I'm hoping that young people will help us build a kind of movement that will make us even more radical today, that will incorporate this understanding of you know, what the capitalist system is all about, that will also incorporate a sense of the structural character of racism, that will incorporate a sense of how much we need to focus on issues of gender, and not just on women's subjugation, but also on issues of transgender oppression. The transgender population and the larger society is criminalized to a greater extent than any other population.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, as we achieve victories, as we make progress, we become aware that the question of freedom is so much more complicated than we ever thought, that it is, you know, so much broader than we ever thought. And that freedom is indivisible. If we want freedom for black people, we also have to say freedom for Palestinian people. And we have to challenge the you know, Israeli occupation of and, you know, military suppression of Gaza. If we want freedom for political prisoners, we have to talk about freedom for all prisoners. And if we want freedom for women prisoners, we have to think about freedom for transgender prisoners. You see what I'm saying? It just each understanding we achieve leads us to yet a further, more complicated engagement with the whole terrain of the struggle for freedom.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I feel we've just barely scratched the surface of all that we can understand about either one of these issues. For those of you, again, Are Prisons Obsolete and Angela's newest book, Abolition Democracy, Beyond Empire, Prisons and Torture. You go out and get them because they're fascinating and truly enlightening as to what is happening in our prison systems. Angela, I want to thank you for being with us this week. And next week, our guest, ladies and gentlemen, will be a former Member of Parliament, George Galloway. And I have a feeling it'll be an interesting evening. Again, our guest tonight, Professor Angela Davis. And thank you, Angela.
And thank you so much for inviting me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Well, I hope to have you back again one day with us.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Good night, folks. That's it.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the stable by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
In our Constitution, the Founding Fathers laid a path to an economy that should have kept Americans free and prosperous. How we the people were tricked off that path into a world of debt and deception reads like one of the great mystery novels of all time. American Free Press compares author Ellen Brown's new book, Web of Debt, to an eye-opening thriller that will leave you feeling like Neo in The Matrix. In Web of Debt, the mysterious and often shocking origins of today's ultimate financial crisis are exposed, starting with its distant beginnings to its present disastrous climax as the reader is shown that the way to restore America's true wealth has been with us all along. Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, to see how America's money and future can become by and for the people once again.